Oh my gosh.
Put your hands together for new Dr. Pepper Blackberry and Dr. Pepper Blackberry Zero Sugar.
There she is! Woohoo! Yeah! It's the old Dr. Pepper!
With sweet blackberry flavor!
Dr. Pepper Blackberry, I'm obsessed with your succulent taste. Please marry me!
No! Marry me! Marry me, or I'm gonna freak out!
Try new Dr. Pepper Blackberry.
It's a pepper thing!
Hi there, folks. Welcome to this book club of the Lotus Eaters, where I'm joined by Stelios.
Hello.
To discuss Herbert Marcuse's One Dimensional Man. Now, this is a book that has a kind of legend about it, because Herbert Marcuse was part of the Frankfurt School, and everyone thinks the Frankfurt School were trying to overthrow Western civilization. And that's only because they were. That's exactly what the Frankfurt School were trying to do. And so, as part of my effort to domesticate them, so we understand them, so we're not intimidated by them, so we can move past them, I'm reading all of their work, and it's dense, to say the least. They are very, I was going to say thorough, but that's not quite the right word. Intransigent writers. They, in many ways, write to be deliberately impenetrable, but they are being very specific about the terms that they're using. So they are deliberate writers. So anyway, One Dimensional Man was published in 1963, and Marcuse is trying to drive towards the liberal ideal, because, of course, he's some sort of uber-communist. And he observes that capitalist Western societies are, in fact, not really any better than Soviet industrial societies when it comes to arriving at the end goal of liberalism, which is communism. And he points out that, the Soviet Union and the capitalist West, the industrial societies, in much the same way as Julius Evola points out, are kind of two prongs of the same beast. And like Evola, he actually wants to overthrow them, but for different reasons. So there's a convergence there. Interesting.
Okay, so for everyone's sake, I'm going to wear the diplomat's earpiece, and whenever you speak, you say the L word, I'm going to translate it into social liberalism in my mind. But okay with that. So the critical theory school, or the Frankfurt theory school, has the reputation you mentioned, and I think it's a reputation that they have earned.
Yeah, they deserve it. It's not unfounded.
They totally deserve it. And my exposure to it isn't that much, because I have studied and being trained much more in the analytic philosophy side of things, although I don't consider myself an analytic thinker. But I really think that it's just they're constantly whining and they don't give solutions. It's like someone who constantly criticizes the imperfections of the world. And okay, I mean, Captain Obvious was here, to be polite and not say the other expression. But yeah, it's just some people who constantly tell us how imperfect the world is. So I don't think they're offering something positive.
Well, it's much more nuanced than that, much more thorough. It's not that they are just mere critics pointing out, oh, here's a problem with the world. The level of their analysis is very high. And these guys were obviously really, really clever. And accurately diagnose some of the problems of modern society that I am personally also very concerned about. So I guess let's just dive into it. So it's in three broad parts. The first one being the one-dimensional society, then the second one being one-dimensional thought, and the third part is the sort of what could the alternatives be, chance of alternatives. And so in the first part, the Marcuse is describing the features of the repressive one-dimensional society. Now, we'll get more into what makes a one-dimensional society a one-dimensional society, but there's a general, and we see this in Marx as well, a kind of lament of a lost feudal order, because that was a two-dimensional society. You had the laboring class, and then you had the aristocratic class. And the aristocratic class were capable of creating high culture. And when this gets merged down into the sort of flat capitalist or Soviet society, this dimension is lost. And they realize the irony of that as well.
I personally don't think that Marx was lamenting the loss of the feudal order, because his dream is a classless society. So
see, I don't read Marx quite like that. If I think that the judgmental language that he uses in the Communist Manifesto is a lament, or makes it a lament for the lost beauty of the aristocratic society. And what Marcuse is trying to do is prevent everyone from moving into the serf labourer category. And he ideally, and this is a steel man of his position, obviously, ideally wants everyone to move up into the aristocratic society so they can enjoy the second dimension of higher culture. Whether that's possible or not.
It's like Stalin, who was riding first class in the train, saying, I hope everyone could have a first class ticket.
Yeah, well, yeah. And because they are in some way sort of on the continuum of liberalism, they originate from the perspective that this is surely open to everyone. But of course, we know that not everyone is capable of the same intellectual capacity. And so there's a universalism to it that belies how obviously nonsense this is going to be.
Yeah.
Like the higher class, the higher arts are not going to be available to everyone merely on an intellectual capacity to be able to experience them in the way that he does. But Marcuse is obviously an incredibly intelligent man. And I find one of the flaws of highly intelligent people is they don't habituate themselves to model the world from another person's perspective, including the conceptual narrowing of what that person is capable of. And so they look at people from other countries and go, well, they're just scientists and doctors like us. It's like, well, not necessarily, actually. But anyway, so chapter one is... another thing is that he views industrial society as fundamentally repressive because it is built on... I guess you could call it a master-slave dialectic, but it's built hierarchically. There are people in charge, there are people who are in the middle, there are working class, and therefore this is repressive because, of course, the structures of society use force to ultimately to keep all of this in line.
I think that will follow because if we accept that the dream of communism in the communist mind is the dream of a classless society,
yeah.
Then they would say that any society that does have clear
stratification
yeah. would be oppressive.
Yeah, and
repressive.
Yeah. He calls it repressive culture. For some reason. But yeah, he definitely believes this. And so chapter one is called The New Forms of Control. And the main point behind this chapter is to explain that the productive forces of capitalism are satisfying the basic needs of the workers to such an extent that it makes resistance to this irrational. So, of course, the revolution is never coming because the workers are all satisfied. Why would they want to revolt? And this was obviously the dream of the Soviets, but the motive is the same on both sides. So, again, he's not pro-Soviet. In the same way that he's not pro-capitalist.
I think it would be helpful to say that the Frankfurt School is called a neo-Marxist school, and it arose by people who sort of understood that the Soviet Union isn't going to work, and they try to find alternative ways of pursuing Marxism.
Yeah, 100%. And so he doesn't remember, but he points out that capitalist society, when it's as productive as the United States was, because of course they fled to the United States, where they worked to undermine that society. When it's as productive as it is, the institutions of society and the status quo itself become self-justifying, which is totally true. Why would we want a revolution if we have everything that we want? And so there's no, it, like he says, becomes irrational to have a revolution. But he points out that a lot of the things people want aren't really actual human needs. They are what Ted Kaczynski called surrogate needs. They're things that have been created by the advertising industry to make you think, oh, I would like that thing, I would like this, I would like that, even though you didn't know they existed 10 minutes ago and now you absolutely have to have them. And so mass media and the advertising industry solidifies the dominant culture's hold on the entire society.
Personally, I think that to an extent that this is true, but personally, I've never felt that much of a pressure.
Well, that's the problem. That's the issue. You don't want revolution because you have a bunch of things that you like and keep you happy.
No, that's my point. That I'm not a materialistic person at all. So all
I didn't
the,
see it.
I'm advertising and all this stuff. They don't affect me.
The point is, all of your material needs are satisfied. Right?
Yeah.
So you've got no objection to the structures of domination that uphold the society. Any objection that you would have would be abstract and conceptual. And practical.
I would press against Marcuse, not against your point, that their way of conceiving of domination is a dead end.
It's
a red herring. Because they have this dream that domination can be completely destroyed, and all the remedy that they're putting forward involves a huge, massive state. Yeah, yeah, okay, I'm going to dominate you. To stop being dominant.
Marcuse isn't in favor of a huge, massive state either. What he's in favor of is some sort of Garden of Eden situation at the end of the universe, where the productivity of the society is so great, and we'll come on to it in a bit, but that there's just no need for people to work. Yeah. So everyone can live like an aristocrat, and there is no hierarchy above them. That's what he's aiming for. So while there is any kind of hierarchy, he views that as a repressive society that is under structures of domination. And in this way, he is correct. That is true that there is, like, the domination, but the word domination implies a much more rough and hard existence than actually really exists. We're definitely bound in golden chains in the modern society. Abundance is just...
I think it has some distinctively Republican origins, which we could talk about another time, but they are essentially saying that they are using the old notion of liberty as non-domination, and they're saying that we can be in a Rousseauian way free if we're not dominated, and to be non-dominated, we must participate in a massive state. But... Maybe he doesn't say exactly that.
He doesn't say that. And he would say that if that's what he wanted. It's not that he wants a massive state. It's that he wants the state to have withered away out of the lack of need for
it. This time it will work.
Yeah, I agree with you. But he is right that the society itself creates a sort of suite of surrogate needs generated by mass media, advertised to you, and gets you bound up in the kind of bourgeois rat race of modern society. And therefore, what he calls this the fulfilling of these needs, a kind of repressive satisfaction. It's like, yes, okay, you've confirmed the system by buying into the system, and you've achieved what you feel to be satisfying in the eyes of everyone else. You're wearing the latest shoes or the latest clothes, whatever. But you didn't need any of these things, and all it does is solidify and justifies the society itself. And therefore, you are being repressed, even though you feel like you're achieving satisfaction.
So, question. I'll try to reframe this or rephrase it, and tell me if you think that that's the idea, if I understand it correctly. So, let's say that I'm a member of mass society. I have a lot of needs that are not actual. I am bombarded by advertisement that says, buy the latest Taylor Swift album.
Yep.
And I think that by buying the latest Taylor Swift album, I'm somehow one of the elite persons on earth.
You're one of the cool kids.
One of the cool kids. And essentially that this is not an actual need for the good life.
Yeah. And what this has also done is it's made you dependent on the system that is artificially producing these desires in you.
Okay.
Which is fair. Which is true, in a very sort of Kaczynski-like way. You know, it's like, yeah, okay, I am satisfying a surrogate need. You know, it's not something that I need to survive, but it's something I want to feel like I'm enjoying the good life. And he points out that, therefore, liberty itself is... This is called liberty. This is packaged as the society as being liberty. And so the concept of liberty itself is made into a powerful instrument of domination. Where there are still masters and slaves, it's just the condition of slavery, in his view, are just far more tolerable when they're packaged in the skin of freedom. And from a sort of extreme communist perspective, yeah, that's true. And so it becomes irrational to revolt against this. Because why would I want to give up all of these things I personally enjoy?
Yeah.
Well, there isn't a good reason. And what this does, in his view, is make society itself totalitarian. So the mass culture of society is everywhere. You can't go, I mean, you know, the fact that I know who Taylor Swift is kind of an indictment against our society and proves his point. I've never bought a Taylor Swift album. I don't listen to the radio. And still I know who Taylor Swift is, right? So he is right that, and you know, if it was true in the 60s, it's definitely true now, that the sort of mass culture of society is almost everywhere all the time. And there's very little space away from the products of technology, advertising, politics, media, and any other sort of the sort of corona of society, of this mass society. It's very hard to get away from, and especially with social media. And like, again, he wouldn't know how much worse it would get through social media. And so he believes that this becomes totalitarian in its effect. And in a way, he's right, because again, he's comparing it to the sort of old world aristocratic society versus the sort of vulgar plebeian society, peasant society. And these things would have had a great distance between them. The average German peasant would never have gone to a high-class theatre and listened to Wagner, for example. You know, this is a society that's completely closed off to him, and so it's completely alien to him.
Does he use the word totalitarian, that yes. mass culture becomes yes. totalitarian?
Yes.
Okay, I have definitely lots of questions here, but...
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I mean, totalitarianism. To my mind, totalitarianism is authoritarianism on steroids, and it definitely involves state oppression. And state oppression, to the extent that the state tries to get into your own mind and penalize you if you don't have the thoughts you must have.
Yeah, but he would say that's true, it's just this is being done by the culture rather than the state.
Yeah, but the point is that if it is done by the culture, it is sort of different because there is no relation of oppression there. And in civil society, we have an actual, not a slogan, diversity of thinking.
Well, he would argue that actually, if you think about it, and he does argue, that you don't actually have a diversity of thinking. What you have is a set of premises that form a kind of closed universe in which there is an apparent high level of divergent thinking, but they all agree on the same premises. So it's actually that this is quite closed, really. It's just that you would view the alternative as being some sort of insane extremism, whereas you're not taking it seriously on its own merits. And the power of the industrial society to produce culture means that you can't really escape from culture. The culture is everywhere all the time, and this is what makes it totalitarian. And again, I think in this way, he's got a point. You know, he's not wrong about that.
I think culture, by definition, is everywhere, because culture is the way we live.
Well, no, because, like you said, in a aristocratic, stratified society, the peasants didn't have access to certain, you know, areas of culture. And in a pre-modern, pre-industrial society, it was very difficult to actually engage in culture a lot of the time. Like, you had to go out of your way to do something that happened rarely. You know, when Shakespeare was putting on a play in the 16th century or whatever, that was a big event. You know, you didn't see that every day. But now you can literally just play it every single day for him on his TV, on his VCR. But for us on the internet, you just watch Shakespeare nonstop all the time. That it's not in any way an event anymore. So the culture is readily on hand, whether you want it or not. And so this is when the luxuries of life become available to all of the classes, which is his primary complaint here, the good life becomes a powerful force which militates against change. So obviously, yeah, I've got all the things I want. Why would I want to change this? Of course, because the revolution becomes an abstract thing. And so this is what creates the one-dimensional society. So he says this. Thus emerges a pattern of one-dimensional thought and behavior in which ideas, aspirations, and objectives that, by their content, transcend the established universe of discourse and action are either repelled or reduced to terms of this universe. They are redefined by the rationality of the given system and of its qualitative extension. And that's what you were doing just a minute ago.
What?
Well, why would I, you know, you're reducing, like, everything to be within the paradigm, right? So you were saying, well, no, we've got a lot of discourse. So, yeah, no, you've got a lot of discourse that's domesticated by the industrial paradigm. But there are worlds outside.
But first of all, how does he explain the fact that he lived in a society where he voiced a different paradigm?
He's just a very clever chap.
It's like Marx saying that all the capitalists would support capitalism, and then he couldn't explain Engels.
Sure.
So it seems to me that what a lot of these people are doing, Marxists, neo-Marxists, they do have something. They have a portion of the truth in what they're saying. Mm. People are not everyone is an Aristotle. And not everyone is capable of autonomous thinking to the degree of an Aristotle. Mm. I think there's no doubt about this. But it seems to me that still the level of, you could say, creativity and individuality we had in societies of the West was far greater than the level of creativity and individuality than in the USSR.
Sure, but the...
So it's more a matter of degrees, the way I see it, rather than saying it's either the case that everyone is an Aristotle or no one is.
Well, he's not saying that everyone has to be an Aristotle. What he's saying is everyone has to be equally free to develop into whatever it is they potentially could be.
And they have taken precisely this to create society of today. Because they constantly put equity in and they say, different needs.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Remember, he's one of the origin points of critical theory.
Yeah.
And so everything about critical theory that followed, it follows from this. So this is the bedrock of it. And so the fundamental problem is that his fundamental problem with this state of affairs, that I think it is an accurate diagnosis, is that it prevents society from reaching the liberal ideal, which is the transcendence of the need for dependence on technology or hierarchy. So people can achieve this level plane where everyone is essentially completely isolated and free to develop in their own ways. He defines progress, which is nice, because very few people do. He says, quote, progress is not a neutral term. It moves towards specific ends, and these ends are defined by the possibilities of ameliorating the human condition. And that's what this is all about.
I mean, this is what it is all about, but the problem with this, for me, is not that it is wrong, but that it is so abstract that we can give entirely conflicting interpretations of it.
Maybe, but it all ends up sort of converging in the same point. I'll save that for now. The advance of technology is, instead of creating true liberation from the human condition, instead creating more advanced forms of containment. So you are still a human with human needs and human desires living in a fundamentally kind of human society. And technology is just making it more likely that you will stay in this society rather than break out of it.
I have something to say about this because I see a lot of people criticizing technology and stuff. For me, it's more an issue of how we use it. I think they do have a point up to an extent. But for instance, I think also some other stuff and I'll make it a bit personal here. One of my relatives is alive right now because of technology. She had cancer, and it was wrapped around the nerve of the foot. And if it was one of the cancerous tissues that required the most cutting-edge technology. So, for instance, if the Enlightenment was pushed back for 10 years, she wouldn't be alive.
Right.
So it seems to me that that's one bit. But I think what they absolutely have a point, and I think here people left and right and center agree on this when it comes to science, is that it leads to what I think critical theorists mention as instrumental rationality. And that leads to also what Heidegger was talking about, treating nature as a resource alone. I think that this is actually what is really tyrannical, because it creates a background framework of thinking where all morality becomes as if.
Yeah.
It's like, in a way, like Kant would say that you don't know if we are moral agents, but you have to view the world as if we're moral agents.
Yeah.
Now this kind of instrumental rationality and the world it creates, the materialistic world, it the materialistic worldview it spills over is literally the background that says we are not moral agents, we have no moral status, but somehow we have evolved with our minds and brains playing this story to us.
So he would say yes, and he would also say that medical technology is a very good thing, obviously. He's entirely in favor of ameliorating the human condition. So he doesn't want, part of the human condition is death.
Yeah.
And so he would say anything that ameliorates that is a good thing. But he would also say, however, concurrent with this and seemingly inextricable to this is the capitalist, and you can say this for the Soviet as well, the raw forces of industrial productivity are also put into creating these surrogate needs and desires. So cancer treatment is not a surrogate need. However, you watching TV when you get home, or you know, scrolling on the internet or whatever it is, these are all surrogate needs, and this dominates everything about society that prevents us from moving into a different kind of society, which is true.
I think you have a point. Tell me if you think that the following question pertains to the discussion right now or for later, but this seems to me to be the exact opposite spirit from the spirit of the Odyssey. Because in the Odyssey, we have the very beginning where Odysseus is presented with by Calypso with a dilemma. Do you want to be immortal here, where you're constantly going to be strong, beautiful, but away from home? Or do you want to go back to live your very limited life back home? And he chooses the latter.
Mm. Yes.
Okay.
He's saying that you should...
They hate the Odyssey, I think.
I don't think they hate it.
Yeah.
But he's definitely arguing that we should make home like the island of Calypso.
Yeah.
He's saying, look, isn't home actually oppressive and painful and difficult? Why don't we transform this into Calypso's island? So anyway, moving on to chapter two, the closing of the political universe. So the main point of this is that society, the industrial society, therefore, closes the avenues of potential political discourse to normalize this one-dimensional society. And obviously it does, and why wouldn't it? There are, of course, obviously the society protects itself from radical revolutionary change because it views itself as having a good thing. And Mark Hughes is like, yeah, but this isn't communist ideal. It's like, no, it's not. And that's his complaint. He says that it does this in four particular ways. Mechanization makes labor easier. So the people doing the labor feel less inclined to revolt. There's a stratification of jobs created between, like, you know, white collar, blue collar, managerial. And this creates a kind of prestige that one layer doesn't want to give up for the others. It also changes the character of the workers who enjoy their work. Mm-hmm. And, they enjoy working with the machines themselves, and they input constructively into the process and don't want to just pack it all in. And therefore, the working class is no longer the living contradiction of the established society that Marx would hold that they are. Actually, no, they've completely sublimated into it.
Yeah.
And they're happy where they are. They like what they do. They don't want to go on strikes. They actually want to get on with their work and things like this. And this makes the working class the slaves of a society and willing participants in their own servitude. But he has optimism. He says, well, look, they all may well be very happy in this society of domination, but that's not going to get us communism, is it? And so what is on the horizon? Well, automation, actually. Automation is the key to transcending the present society. So when all of the jobs are automated and we have no choice but to live like French aristocrats in the twilight of the Ancien Régime.
Oh, I hope not.
All these people are just going to have no jobs, and so they're going to have no choice. Everything will just be provided to them by a machine at some point.
I mean, I think life is just striving. It's... if everything is just given to you by
machines, that's the human condition, and we're trying to ameliorate the human condition. That's literally... I agree with you. I completely agree with you.
That's a problem. It's in some cases, I think the fundamental problem with a lot of philosophers and with the Enlightenment in this case, I think a lot of Enlightenment thinkers have it massively mistaken here, wrong, is that you can't convince everyone. There are some just hard disagreements that are irresolvable. People who are just going to say, we need to accept life.
Yeah.
And human wisdom says we need to accept our mortality.
Yeah.
Are never going to agree with people who are going to rebel against it in their own minds.
I'm just completely against the total amelioration of the human condition. I think that's an awful thing, because that means that we're no longer humans, become something else. But anyway, so he thinks that automation can ultimately provide the circumstances so we can transcend a system of domination. So there won't need to be classes, because of course, what would put someone in a greater class than anyone else? And the way that the state operates at the moment is something he calls the welfare and warfare state. So the society conducts warfare overseas and provides welfare to those people at the bottom in order to maintain a kind of equilibrium in the middle. So most people fall into the middle category of fairly happy and productive workers. And the productivity of the industrial society allows us to drone strike, or not in drone strike in his day, but just bomb, you know, people around the world. And any people who would have formed a kind of critical revolutionary conscious are given enough welfare so they can afford the luxuries of society in the main. And therefore, nothing will change. This will go on forever, as far as he's concerned, which is a problem because he wants revolution. This moves us on to chapter 3. The conquest of the unhappy consciousness. Because it is true that there's something wrong with industrial society. This isn't, as you say, you know, man needs to struggle. Actually, we need to strive for something. And if you're given everything for free, and you've only got one thing you can basically do, which is just work, there's a need for therapists. Because a therapist is fundamentally an outgrowth of the modern era. Say, look, you're living in a relatively unnatural state, and I need to essentially sort of massage your brain to get you to accept this unnatural state of affairs that's making you depressed, paranoid, or whatever mental issues you're coming up with that you otherwise wouldn't have had in a pre-modern society, because you would have joined a convent or something like that. You'd have done something metaphysical or, you know, insane. But instead, the sort of one-dimensional state, it's just like, well, you just go to the therapist and we'll just brainwash you into going back into the way things are now that are causing you to be unhappy. And this is what the conquest of the unhappy consciousness is. And the way it does this is by the mass production of art. And it kind of sublimates art into itself, which he calls repressive sublimation. In order to kind of integrate it into the mass popular culture. Now, of course, what this does is destroys the transcendental nature of art. So, and this is where he brings up the aristocratic society being two-dimensional and therefore having this kind of realm of art that is otherwise unavailable to the masses. And, you know, occasionally you might get like a peasant who for some reason can afford to get into, you know, a theatre hall or something while Beethoven's playing. And have this transcendental experience. And that'll be something he'll remember forever.
So I have an issue with this thought. And maybe I have misunderstood it. But let's say that I love classical music. I do love classical music. And I love Pavarotti.
Sure.
It's my favorite tenor. It's just raw power.
Yeah.
And I love Nessun Dorma, the aria. It seems to me to be one of the closest things to a just transformative experience.
Mm-hmm.
It's just magical.
Mm-hmm.
I just interact with it and I find it very uplifting and psychically rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care if a lot of people have access to it or not. And well, I don't care if I watch it, I go, if a lot of people can access it. So to me, the idea that the mass society can give art and it can make art accessible to a lot of people has nothing to do with how I interact with it. So it would seem to me that if that's his beef with
it's not entirely.
Okay, but
what's
the problem? If I can go and interact with, let's say, a tragic play and say that, well played. What's the issue if a lot of people have access to it?
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.